thanks, Adam, and thanks everybody for showing up. It's a bit of a long title. So it spells out renormalization of tensor networks using graph-independent local truncations. Let me explain that for you a little. So graph-independent local truncations is going to be shortened to GILT or GILT. That's the thing we came up with. So what this really says is RG on tensor networks using the thing I'm going to explain to you. And this is work with Clément Delcam and Sebastian Misera, who are Sebastians over there. And they are also PhD students at PI like me. So first, a very brief intro to tensor networks. I'm going to be using this diagrammatic language a lot. So in these diagrams, each of these blobs is a tensor, and each of these sticks sticking out is an index, or I'm going to be calling them bonds or legs. Each index has a range, goes over some number of values. That's called a bond dimension of that bond. When you put two tensors next to each other, you're taking the tensor product. And then when you connect two legs like this, you're identifying them and summing over it. So this equation is just that same equation written in the diagrammatic language. A common operation you often end up doing with these tensor networks is taking a tensor and doing a singular value decomposition, or SVD. So you may know that as a matrix operation. You can also do it on tensors. That just means you take all the legs of the tensor, split them so that half of them are on one side of the decomposition and half are on the other side. So here are these two and these two. And then it gives you a decomposition in terms of a unitary tensor, so unitary from these two legs to that leg, another unitary on the other side, and then singular values in the middle. So S is a diagonal matrix with positive or non-negative values on the diagonal. And this can often be used to split tensors like this into two parts by just absorbing S into U or V or a bit into both. If here all the bond dimensions are chi, whenever there's a chi in this presentation, it's always some kind of bond dimension. If these are all chi, then that middle leg is going to be chi squared. Often you don't quite want it to be that. You want to truncate it down, possibly causing a small error in doing so, into some other dimension chi prime. So imagine here that this is your matrix of singular values. Well, you can immediately spot that one of them is zero. You can throw it out, you lose nothing. You can. So here, chi would be 2, and chi squared would be 4, so this would be a 4x4 matrix. But you can make it to be a 3x3 matrix, and you've lost nothing but a contribution to the sum that is 0 anyway. So now your chi prime would be 3. You may also choose to throw out something that is 10 to minus 9, and the largest one has been normalized to 1. And then you'll be causing a small error, meaning this thing is no longer quite the same thing as the original tensor, but it is that up to 10 to minus 9. Then your chi prime would be 2. You would only be keeping this part. You could also choose to throw out this one, but that's probably a bad idea. Now you start to really lose significant parts of your tensor network, meaning this describes some physics. It's not going to be describing the same physics anymore. So this is something that will come up often. I talk about truncations and truncation errors. And it usually means something like this, often done with a singular value decomposition, which is in some sense an optimal way of doing a lot of truncations, sometimes done using other methods. All right, so how do we describe physics with these things? Well, there's a few different ways, but I'm going to be concentrating on this one. So imagine you have a lattice of some classical variables. I'm going to call them sigma I and think of them as spins. They don't have to be spins. And then there's some Boltzmann weight, some energy of nearest neighbors that gives you Boltzmann weights. And then you want to compute, for instance, the partition function. So you have a sum over all the different variables on your lattice. And this in this network would correspond to all these different legs, which, since they're connected legs, you're summing over them. So that's a sum over a single spin. And these tensors would then encode somehow the Boltzmann weights in a way that is here, but the details are not. You don't need to understand that to be able to follow what I'm saying. Just get the intuitive idea that each of these tensors describes, for instance, this one tells us how these four spins interact. What are the energies of the nearest neighbor interaction? And then a network like this, where there are no open indices, these indices loop around here, so all the indices are closed, gives me a number, a scalar, and that is the partition function. So this is a way of formulating the computing of a partition function from a classical model into a tensor network. You could also do a lot of other things with very similar looking networks. For instance, you could put in some kind of operator over there as a matrix, and then divide by Z, and you would be computing the expectation value of this operator. You could do two-point correlators or whatever you want. You could also be looking at quantum systems instead. So instead of 2D quantum systems, sorry, 2D classical systems, you could be looking at 1D quantum systems, where the system would now live here. This would be these open indices, which are no longer summed over, would be your, say, spin chain, and then you would have some Hamiltonian on it, and this whole thing would be an operator from these legs to these legs, and that would be, in this case, the exponential of your Hamiltonian, so a thermal state. And now these individual tensors would somehow come from the local terms of your Hamiltonian. So the point that I'm trying to say, get through here is that I'll be concentrating on talking about partition functions, networks like these describing partition functions, but everything I do with these tensor networks could just as well be applied to networks like these, or networks like these, or you could be looking at ground states or expectation values of ground states. So I'll just stick to this language for concreteness. But if you don't care about classical partition functions, but you do care about spin chains, then this stuff is going to be equally applicable to that.
Is all this fundamentally different from writing down a state, a pure state as a fundamental tensor network?
A pure state for a quantum system?
Yeah.
No, it's not fundamentally different. Are you thinking in terms of like a MERA or some tensor network describing a ground state, for instance, what is often given?
For example.
Yeah. Like, you could just make this beta here, which is the inverse temperature in the quantum case, be essentially infinite. Right. So look at a network that lives not on a finite strip like this, but instead is infinite in that direction, and that would give you the ground state. Or, yeah, there's other methods like an MPS, or many other tensor networks could describe other kinds of pure state as well, but, yeah. So, this network, oh my cursor is in the way. This network here could be a partition function, now we want to know what the value of it is. We just want to contract this network. Well, you could start by just putting these two together, and then putting together with that, and with that, and with that, and go about doing it piece by piece, but that's a bad idea. You think about it a bit, and you realize that the computational cost of doing that is exponential in system size, so the system size would be the size of this network. So we should probably do something a little more clever, and here's one thing you could try doing. Some kind of RG idea. Let's not specify yet exactly what, but somehow map this into another network that contracts to the same value, such that each of these tensors, like for instance that one, would now correspond to a bunch of spins over here. You are doing some kind of scale transformation, some kind of coarse graining. And then you could repeat this coarse graining a few times and end up with a network that start with million by million spins, and you do it a few times, and you only have a few tensors left, and then you can just do the contraction, and you have your number. Probably you have to do some kind of truncation here. So for instance, a really simple way of doing this would be just taking these four, contracting them into a single thing, think of these two indices as a single index over here, but that would then have a larger bond dimension. And if you don't do any truncations during this procedure, your bond dimension will be growing, and you'll run into computational trouble. But you can do truncations, and hopefully you'll be able to throw out irrelevant UV details that you don't care about, and be able to run through this whole procedure for a large system. Here, if you get a method like this working, the cost in terms of the system size would be logarithmic. So you're already doing much better in that sense. So this could yield you numbers like partition functions or expectation values or whatever you like. But this also has a nice feature of you could be looking at RG flows in the space of tensors. You could really be thinking of these tensors as describing your physics at a longer length scale, and then think about what does the RG flow look like. So here's one way of looking at it, and I'm going to show you this one plot. This comes from a specific way of doing RG, which is not important so far. I'm just going to try to give you the idea of what these plots are about. There's going to be plenty of these later on. So take one of your coarse-grained tensors, do the SVD, and look at the singular values. Let me just tell you about the structure of the tensor. There's something that is basis independent. And then plot them like this here. The horizontal axis is the linear system size, so the RG flow goes from over here to over here, going from one point to the next one on the right means doing one more step of RG. And at each point of the horizontal axis, we plot the singular values. So That's the largest singular value, that's the second largest singular value, the third largest, and so forth. And then you can follow how they develop along the RJ flow when you keep doing something like this. And you can see that there's some kind of fixed point that is reached, and now we could start asking questions about what are the structures of these fixed points and so forth. And I'm going to be doing that in a moment for a specific RG method, an RG algorithm. So this is the one that got it all started. It's called Tensor Renormalization Group by Levin and Nave from 06. I'm going to be calling this TRG for short. And this is a simple algorithm that just does splits and contractions. You take that tensor and you split it like that. Take that tensor and split it the other way. Split all of these in two different ways. And then say, take those four, contract them into a new one. Those four, contract all of that one. And you've done some kind of scale transformation. Now each of these represents two of the original ones. And then you could keep iterating this and run all the stuff from the previous slide. So this is all good. This is actually a very good method for evaluating the value of your network. If you want to evaluate observables for some model, this is a completely fine method. It's really simple to implement and runs pretty fast and gives you decent approximations to the observables. Of course, you do have to do truncations here. So if you don't truncate, that bond is chi squared, meaning that is chi squared, and the next one's going to be chi to the fourth, chi to the eighth, and so forth. So you have to start truncating and throwing something out. But you can keep throwing out things that are not too important for the IR physics, which is what you care about. So let's take a look at the RG flows this method gives us. This is for the Ising model. The plot from the previous slide is one of these. That's the critical point. These two are in the high temperature phase. That's a bit deeper in the high temperature phase than that. That one's really close to a critical point. And these are the same things, but on the low temperature side. And there's something here that immediately, hopefully, strikes you as a bit weird and not quite right, which is that these two fixed points, all of these reach some kind of fixed point, but for instance, these two fixed points, even though they're in the same phase, so the same, it's the same IR physics, the same universal physics, the fixed points look different. And the same thing happens over here. These two don't look the same. So somehow that tells us that this stuff that keeps changing is non-universal. This is some kind of UV stuff that probably shouldn't really be there when you talk about the RG fixed point, if you think about RG the way physicists usually do. So it's an artifact of this RG method that it doesn't really clean up all the short-range details when it moves on to the next length scale. And there's a nice toy model that helps us understand why this happens, which looks like this. So here, each of these blue blobs is one of the tensors. This is like a specific case of let's choose our tensors over here to be of this form. There are these blue blobs that secretly inside contain matrices that form these closed loops of correlations around the plaquettes. This is not a physical model. This is not the Boltzmann weights of some lattice model. But this is a toy model for extremely short-range correlation, extremely strong short-range correlations. So if you imagine putting an operator over here and an operator over here, the expectation values would be highly correlated because there's a loop that connects these two. But any operator separated by more than the lattice spacing would be completely uncorrelated. The correlation functions would factorize to one-point correlation functions. There's nothing happening that connects that to that. So naturally, the RG fixed point of this should be something completely trivial. If you look at this at long length scales, then there's nothing interesting happening. But turns out this is actually a fixed point of this TRG transformation. So if you just run this algorithm for these tensors, some of these loops end up getting promoted to loops over here. So somehow something that is supposed to be describing strictly UV details becomes part of the description at the next length scale. Which isn't numerically, it's a bit of a, it's a hindrance numerically speaking. So if your IR physics is completely trivial, you could imagine that it could be perhaps in this case described by a one dimension one tensor, just scalars. Then the fact that you have to keep these loops around, keep the local correlations around, puts a strain on your one dimension. You have to use a bit more one dimension than you usually would. which affects your numerical results, but it's, you can deal with it, it's all right. The problem is actually way, way worse in higher dimensions. This is kind of a specialty in 2D that you can get away with having these kinds of issues. I'll talk a little bit about 3D at the end. But it's conceptually, this is what goes wrong in terms of why were the RG flows so weird. So I would say that TRG is a useful tensor network transformation that does some kind of coarse graining, but it's not really RG the way we are used to thinking about RG. So since this toy model with these loops is really handy for understanding how these local correlations behave under different kinds of tensor network algorithms, I'm going to be drawing these red shadings. I hope you can see them in my tensor networks, which are not part of the tensor network diagrammatic language. These don't have a strictly well-defined meaning. I'm just schematically illustrating loops of local correlations like these, and then you can follow how they behave along the algorithm. I'm saying this because I'm going to be using the same shading in a few drawings later on. So it's kind of like a handy way of putting this picture schematically into the same diagram. So we have some kind of scale transformation here, but it's not quite RG. Luckily, somebody solved this for us. Originally, Giffre and Glenn Evenblu did. So they developed an algorithm called tensor network renormalization, which is summarized here. I'm not going to go through the details of it, but it may not look like it, but this is actually in many ways a lot like the previous algorithm, TRG, the simple split and contract algorithm. The new thing here and the key thing here is these blue things, which are called disentanglers. These are some kind of two-side unitary gates that do some local juggling around of your degrees of freedom that get rid of the UV correlations that TRG did not deal with properly. Oh, I should say at this point, by the way, that every time I say local correlations and I draw pictures like these, if you like thinking in terms of quantum systems rather than classical systems, then that means local entanglement. If this would be a network describing some quantum state, then those would be directly entanglement between nearest neighbors, for instance. So if you're familiar with MERA, the tensor network, then these are exactly the same disentanglers as the disentanglers in MERA. If you're not familiar, then that's all right. So that's an algorithm that fixes the problem TRG had. It gives you RG flows that look physically correct. It gives you also numerically more accurate results for the same bond dimension because you're no longer polluting your tensors with these UV details that don't really matter for what you're trying to calculate. It's not the only method to be capable of this. It was the first one, but then there's one called Loop DNR by Shua Young and her collaborator. Shua used to be a postdoc here until I think a few months ago. There's one called DNR Plus by the group in Ghent. There's a more recent one called Tensor Network Skeletonization. And these all do qualitatively the same kind of job. They all, I would say that they're all proper RG algorithms for tensor networks. So at this point, you may be asking, well, why am I giving this talk? Because I just told you that there's a solution to this problem that I was introducing earlier. And the reason I'm giving this talk is because we are not, or we weren't fully happy with the solutions these were offering. And the reason is, they work, they do work, but first of all, these are significantly more complicated to implement than this simple TRG thing where you just split and contract. All of these involve some kind of cost function that measures your truncation error, and then there's some kind of iterative optimization for finding a hopefully global minimum of your cost function, and it gets, the details of it require some work to get right. That's not so bad. What bothered us more is the fact that these methods are kind of hard to generalize. So for instance, this is written here down for the square lattice. If you ask me how to do this on a hexagonal lattice, there's probably a way to do it, but it requires some, it's not obvious. You have to think about it. Where do I put my disentanglers? How do these things go together? How does this work? And actually, the way we got started with this whole project was trying to take this method or any of the others, but we were working with this one, and try to do it in 3D. In principle, there's no issue. Like, conceptually, you know what you want to do, and there's no fundamental obstacle why you couldn't do it. But the details of it get quite messy, and then you work through the messy details, and you start looking at the computational cost of the thing you just designed, and then you start to despair. So we were really wondering, wouldn't there be a way to do this that would be, hopefully, simpler, maybe cheaper computationally, and most importantly, more generalizable. More kind of like straight to the core of the issue. So the hope would be something like this. You have a tensor network, which doesn't have to be a plaquette of the square lattice, but I just drew that here. It could be anything. But there's something in it, in this tensor network, some kind of local correlations that have no effect on the output on the external layers. And then we would like to go from that to a network where we've done minimal changes. We've only changed these two tensors and truncated that one bond, and we've somehow cut this local correlations away. You could do this on all the legs and remove all of them. So we would like to separate the changing of the UV physics in terms of RG terms. We're changing the UV physics. So for instance, if I had a two-point correlator of an operator on this leg and an operator on that leg, doing something like that would change the correlator a lot. Like any physics within this plaquette would change a lot. But anything that is a two-point correlator between an operator over here and somewhere further out would not be affected. So changing the UV physics, you're hopefully simplifying the UV physics, which allows you to reduce the bond dimension, but in such a way that the IR stays the same. And the hope would be that this would be combining this with TRG on some other really simple way of just putting tensors together to do a scale transformation would be a really simple, cheap, and general way of doing proper RG on tensor networks. And this is what this GILT does for you. So these graph-independent local truncations, which I'm calling GILT, is achieving exactly this goal. And here's a couple of schematic intermediate steps. So what it does is it starts with this, it inserts some matrix, so this is two legs, it's a matrix, goes on that leg without affecting the value of this network as a whole, and then you can decompose this matrix into two parts, and that bond dimension in the middle is going to be lower, so this is a chi by chi matrix with rank chi prime, so I can decompose it with a bond dimension of chi prime, and I just absorb that into there and that into there and get over here. I'm going to explain this in way more detail, but that's just to give you the overall idea of where this algorithm is going. So I seem to be well on time at this point, so maybe I'll take questions. So I'm going to slide 6 out of 11. The next two slides are going to be a more detailed explanation of how this GILT stuff works. Up to this point, it's all been review of what others have been doing. Next two slides explain how the thing works that we introduced. And then there's going to be one slide of 2D benchmark results, one slide of summary, and one slide of outlook in 3D. And that's going to be the future of this talk. So any questions at this point? Is everybody following the basic idea?
I have two questions.
Yes.
First is, in a previous slide, you mentioned generalizing something to 3D. In 2D, in this algorithm, you seem to be going from one lattice to one that is kind of dual, rotated by 45 degrees. Now, if you think about that in 3D, you would go from a cube to an octahedron or something,
yeah.
Very different shape.
Yeah. So in 3D, what you usually, going from, the fact that this algorithm goes from that lattice to the dual lattice, and then when you apply it again, it goes back to the original configuration, is a feature of the TRG algorithm, but there's quite an easy way of designing something that does qualitatively the same job as TRG, but does not do this. It just goes back to the square lattice. And it has all the same
yeah,
rough benefits and issues.
That in the dual lattice, you don't get cubes anymore. You have some other geometric shapes that
yes.
have many more faces or edges or something.
So yes,
it would be complicated.
We thought about this for a while, and then we decided to instead go with a coarse graining method, go with a TRG-like algorithm that just goes from the cubical lattice to the cubical lattice, because it's quite easy to find one.
Okay.
You can let me point out at this point that the fact that TRG has this issue of local correlations not quite working out the way they should is something that there's a lot of different algorithms, kind of like DRG, that you can design based on just putting things together and splitting them apart and putting things together and splitting them apart. And I don't have a strict proof, but I don't think any of them can fix this issue. You have to do something slightly different. But it's quite easy to come up with a way of putting things together and splitting them apart algorithm that just goes from square lattice directly to square lattice. You had another question?
And the other question was regarding the cleanup procedure that you're proposing, the graph independent one. So you're looking for things that live on loops, and you're going to act on individual edges?
Yes, but we...
So when, do you have to do it four times to get it rid of it and all the edges? So how does that look like?
Yes. First of all, when we're looking at, when we're doing something on the single edge, we have to kind of like take into account that it's living on this loop. Otherwise, we can't deal with this.
Right, in 3D, one edge lives on n number of loops or something.
And then you could, for instance, truncate the same leg several times, considering the different cubes for which.
So I guess you'll explain why you chose this particular answer.
Yes, and you could actually, you could apply this algorithm choosing slightly different environments, as we call them, or neighborhoods. So when we do this truncation, we always do it in some neighborhood, considering all the correlations that are local to this neighborhood. And you could choose a single plaquette. You could actually choose two neighboring plaquettes. It's a little more computationally expensive, probably a little more accurate. There's a lot of small choices you can do there. But yes, you can iterate this and, for instance, run the same algorithm on all these four legs or truncate the same legs several times with different environments.
Very good. Thank you.
I have a question about the Ising example that you gave.
Mm-hmm.
So despite indeed in this being in the same phase, sort of the fixed point of the tensors seem to be different. But to what extent does that actually reflect information about the phase, the singular values that you have there? And I mean, even though the temperature, they're in the same phase, they have different still measurable quantities, like say magnetization or something. Can you extract that from the singular values?
Not directly from the singular values, but from the tensors, yes.
But is that the reason why they're different, or?
No, I wouldn't say so, because the differences you have within the phase are not really, how would I say, they shouldn't affect the structure of your tensors. They would be things like the magnetization gets scaled up or down a little once you go to the IR. Well, maybe that's not what you're thinking of. If you go to the thermodynamic limit, then regardless of what your temperature is, your physics should be of the same form. They should behave in the same manner, and that should be reflected in the structure of these tensors. That's why I'm saying that.
The spacings between the singular values should be the same?
Yes. They should. In fact, what I would expect to happen here is I would expect in this high temperature phase, for instance, there to be only a single dominant singular value, and all of the others should go away. Because that's what happens if you push this to infinite temperature, for instance. That's the tensor, because that just describes a disordered phase where there really isn't anything interesting happening because it's infinite temperature. And that's where I should expect this to drift when you just go to large enough system size, as long as you're in that phase. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So I'm actually concerned about this now. The fact that, you know, two different points in the same phase do have different values of the same quantities, you know, like specific heats and susceptibilities. If they don't show up in the singular values, where will they show up?
For instance, in the norm of the tensor.
But okay.
I mean, yeah, and there's So the spectrum isn't giving you everything about the tensor. You could still scale it by a scalar, and there's also unitary changes of bases you could do on the legs.
I see. But if you look at a susceptibility graph, it goes like that. So, I mean, it doesn't seem that, chi or chi prime or the derivative of chi, where chi is a susceptibility, should just be a difference in norm. There's some non-trivial... It's not linear, right? It's curved, the graph.
Yes, but I don't see why it should be linear. I mean, at every... you run this algorithm at every different temperature?
The susceptibility calculation won't be linear in the tensors.
Sorry?
Okay.
It's not linear in the tensor, no.
Yeah.
You run this at different temperatures and it gives you different tensors, and they could be able to represent all those points.
I have a very stupid question. why is your RG flow going the wrong way? It's going from small systems to big systems.
Oh, effectively read this as, what is the size of the system that a single tensor is describing?
Oh.
Does that? Yeah, OK. Yeah. So if I take a single tensor and contract it, what's the system size? All right. Yes. Anything more?
Please tell me more.
So before, all right, so now I'm going to explain you how this guilt works. And before I go directly into that, let me talk about something more general, and then guilt will be a special case of this. I just find it easier to explain the general philosophy first and then go to the special case. So take any tensor network. I just drew something out of my hat here. I'm going to call it N4 neighborhood. It's probably in the local patch of some global network because you don't want to be thinking about the global thing. And then you want to identify something in it, and I'm going to call R, that I want to change. I want to replace R with R prime, but in such a way that these two networks are still the same. I want to do some kind of changes within this neighborhood that don't affect physics on the level of this neighborhood. And I want to know what are all the different R primes that I could choose. What's the freedom that I have in fixing this R prime? To answer that, you should take this neighborhood and remove R from it, get a network like that. Think of it as a linear map from all of these internal indices, the external indices, so these internal ones are the ones that connect to R. So think of it as a matrix like that, and then singular value dingle closure. This is like the motto of my PhD, always SVD when you can, always makes life better. Turns out, this SVD tells you exactly what you want. So these singular values here, if all of them are non-zero, then this map, this environment, we call this thing the environment, it's a map from these legs to the external legs, is full rank. There's nothing in that case that you can do to change R without changing also what happens on the external legs. But if there's some zero values in the singular value spectrum, then you have a kernel. Then there's some subspace. So let's imagine, for instance, that the last three singular values in S are zero. Then you have three corresponding singular vectors in U that span the kernel or the null subspace, the space of vectors or the space of tensors in the space of these four legs that get mapped to zero by this map. And that's exactly what we want, because then we know that if we replace R with R prime, then these two networks have the same value as long as the difference between R and R prime is in this kernel. Then the difference gets mapped to zero by the environment, and we've done nothing. And I write this kernel as the kernel of S times U, because this V dagger in the single value decomposition plays no role. We just don't need it. So this is kind of neat. We have an if and only if characterization of all the local replacements we can do in a tensor network. And to find out what the freedom is that we have, all we have to do is take this environment and SVD it and look at the singular values and the singular vectors. And hopefully, if you're looking at a small local patch, then that SVD should be doable. Now, the way we get from here to guilt is restrict ourselves to looking at a case where R, the supplement network that we are doing changes in, is just a single leg. So again, the neighborhood could be any generic tensor network. I'm just starting to draw something that, again, looks more like the square placket. So that's what we're going to be using for the RG purposes. But now R is just that individual leg. So if you want to think of it as a tensor, it's the identity matrix connecting that point and that point. And then we want to do something like this. We want to replace that identity matrix with another matrix I'm going to call R prime. And just run the exact same stuff as in the previous slide. So the environment is this. When you remove R, you just cut that leg open. And the SVD you do is that. That's your U and that's your S. If you want to think about something that may help the intuition here is that S is is effectively the entanglement spectrum between these two legs and these external legs, the internal legs and the external legs. If you want to think of this whole tensor network as a quantum state, I'm saying physically speaking actually is a quantum state, but you can use the same terminology as you use for many body quantum states, then that's the entanglement spectrum. It tells you how badly these internal legs are connected to the external legs. So that's then just the expression from the last slide, rewritten in this special case when R is a single leg. So the difference between R, meaning the identity matrix, and R prime, which is what we're inserting over there, should be in this kernel defined by these two things. And then you work on that expression a little, sorry. And this turns out to be equivalent to saying that our R prime, which we are putting in this network, is a linear combination of the singular vectors coming from this SVD, UIs, with some coefficient T prime I. So for every singular value in S, there's a corresponding singular vector and there's a corresponding weight in this linear combination, this sum called Ti prime. And if the corresponding singular value is larger than zero, then this Ti prime is fixed for. It doesn't really matter for you what the value is, but it's fixed. You can't change it if you want that equation over there to hold. That would be doing changes outside of this kernel. But if your corresponding singular value is zero, then you can change it. Then you are free to choose this coefficient Ti prime as you wish. So again, if we have three zero values at the end of the spectrum, that means we have a three-dimensional kernel. And that means that in choosing this R prime matrix, it's some linear combination of a lot of matrices, but three of the coefficients we are free to choose. If we couldn't choose any of them, then the only solution would be to have R prime be the identity. But now we have three axes along which we can start making changes. And every time I say here that something is zero, I mean approximately zero, because this is going to be working numerically. So for instance, saying here that the singular values are larger than zero, I really mean that they're larger than some epsilon that you choose, and saying that they are, sorry, that they're non-zero is larger than epsilon, that they're zero means smaller than epsilon, and then that equality is going to hold up to epsilon corrections. So here we have now a full characterization of replacements we can do on the single leg. What can we do to change that leg R? Yeah.
Sorry, why isn't Ti prime 1 upon trace u?
Sorry, why isn't Ti prime?
Isn't it 1 upon trace u? Don't you want to cancel the trace?
No. Wait, can I give you a simple explanation of why? It's better if I explain that to you later.
Okay.
I can't find a two-sentence way of describing it. I would have to go through the calculation of how you end up with it. If you would choose all the Ti primes here to be this, then R prime would be the identity matrix.
Oh, is it because you used U daggers are unitary?
Yes, that's where it comes from.
Trace of U daggers 1 upon trace U.
Okay. Well, you answered quicker for yourself than I could have. Yeah. So we have this freedom. We've identified the freedom that we have. How do we want to use this freedom? It's the fundamental question of life. What we want to do is insert this matrix over here and then split it, like I showed you earlier, with rank chi prime. And then this chi prime is going to be our new bond dimension over here. So what we want to minimize, how we want to choose these Ti primes is to minimize the rank of R prime, which I'm calling chi prime. That allows us to do most efficient possible truncation, which means removing as much of the local details that are internal to this loop as possible. So okay, that's pretty much, we're pretty much done with this. There's a slight technicality because it turns out that this is not a very easy cost function to solve for. Up to this point, I've been really happy that there's been no optimization of anything, any kind of iterative conjugate gradient, none of that. Everything has been these nice if and only if statements. At this point, we could start doing some kind of more complicated optimization for this, so optimize for rank of R prime as a function of these T primes. Instead, what we choose to do is we choose a slightly different cost function that in most cases incentivizes the same kind of solutions, incentivizes R prime to have small rank, and that does the job. You can come up with corner cases where it doesn't work, but if you just use this in coarse grading a physical model, it seems to work most of the time. Well, it seems to work in all the cases that we've tried, except for the corner cases we came up with just for the sake of proving that it can fail. I'm not planning on explaining you how exactly this works unless you care about the data. Eric, do you have a question?
No.
All right, so that's the guild procedure for you. This is how we perform these truncations that we aim to perform.
What's the cost?
One dimension of the six for the square placket. Depends on the environment, but for the square placket, for this case, it's one dimension of the six, which is the same as the cost of DNR and loop DNR. So you could plausibly use this in a bunch of different ways in different tensor networks context. I mean, I think about these networks all day, every day, so I have high hopes for other ways of using this. But for the purposes of this talk, we are going to be using it for doing the RG we were talking about earlier. So we are calling guild TNR. This here is just DRG, these three steps. You take these tensors, you split them, contract them, and then you could go back there and do it again. And all we do is we look at what were the plaquettes that DRG had trouble dealing with correctly. There were local correlations about some of these plaquettes that DRG couldn't quite handle right. And then we just run this guild thing, truncating all the legs, using those plaquettes as the environment. So we could actually remove all of these local correlations, but that's not necessary because, for instance, what's in this plaquette gets dealt with by TRG well enough already. So this is just introducing four different R prime tensors in this, or matrices on this network that do truncations of all the legs and remove the tricky bits.
When you say introducing tensors, you introduce them as SVD tensors, or?
I mean,
tensors.
I mean introducing these R prime matrices the way we did here, so doing this step. And then we do split at the end. We do SVD that R prime like that.
Okay.
And then we kind of like absorb these two things in the neighboring tensor. So that at the end, we've ended up in a situation like that, where we've modified some of the tensors by absorbing these R prime matrices in. And yeah, the cost of any reasonable tensor network algorithm should scale as some polynomial of the one dimension where the exponent is not dependent on system size. For instance, here it's chi to the sixth, which is the same as TNR or loop TNR. So no great difference there. So here's some RG flows for you to show that this works. This is for the 2D classical Ising model again. These are the exact same plots you saw earlier. So these are the RG flows of the tensors or TRG. So just doing these three steps. And then if you add these two, the RG flows change, and now they look much better. So here you have in the low temperature phase, for instance, this RG fixed point where all the other singular values here go to zero, but two remain, and they are degenerate. So that makes sense. This is the symmetry breaking phase. And if you change the temperature slightly, the RG flow changes for some range of system size. It takes longer to flow to the IR, but at the end, you end up at the same IR fixed point. And the same thing over here. And at the critical point, you see this complicated fixed point, which we can, this will eventually actually fall into one of the phases, but for a significant amount of time, it clearly reaches some kind of fixed point, which is the CFD, essentially. So qualitatively speaking, you could say that these represent the scaling operators of your conformal field theory at the fixed point.
Can you get the exponents for that?
Yes, I'm going to be showing them. No. Not quite from this spectrum, but from a very, very similar spectrum. Yeah.
Can you explain what this has to do with the scaling operators?
Sorry?
Can you explain what this has to do with the scaling operators?
The more precise statement would be if you make a transfer matrix of these tensors that lives on a cylinder. So you put some of the tensors together to form a ring. And you diagonalize that, you look at the spectrum of that thing, which is not too different from looking at the spectrum of a single tensor, then that's a transfer that's a transfer operator on the cylinder. And then from the CFT, you can get through the logarithmic map that actually the spectrum of that gives you, the spectrum of that is exponentials of the scaling dimensions of the scaling operators. And that's exactly, I'm going to be in two slides, you'll see exactly those results, and that's how we got. So okay, this is supposed to show you that we are conceptually fixing the problem that TRG had with the RG flows. Here's some results that show that it also improves the numerical performance, as it should. So this is the error in the free energy at criticality compared to the exact solution. The other axis is bond dimension. Results get better as bond dimension increases, as they should. They get better way faster for us than they do for TRG. And so this here is like 3 orders of magnitude. That's an order of magnitude. We've also printed out here the actual running times in minutes of these algorithms, just to show that, for instance, here, at, if you have only a minute, you need to get results fast. You're probably better off running TRG. Performs slightly better for really, really short run times that only go to somewhat higher bond dimensions. For instance, here we are getting 3 orders of magnitude better results. We are only getting them with like 1.5 times the running time. So this makes me happy. But this is to be expected. Of course, it's nice that the running time doesn't increase too much. But if you're doing something fancy where you remove all these UV details that were polluting your tensors earlier, then you can fit more of the IR physics into the same bond dimension. So for the same bond dimension, you should be getting better estimates for your observables. So, and I should point out at this point that TNR and loop TNR and TNR plus and all the algorithms that properly do RG get qualitatively similar looking spectra and also improve on TRG results. Of course, we want to do some kind of comparison between these algorithms. So these are exactly the scaling dimensions of the Ising CFT. Those are the first few of them. Those are the exact values, and these are done by taking a transfer matrix on a cylinder and diagonalizing that, which is just put tensors next to each other and do the diagonalization. The summary of this is roughly that all of these fancier methods beat TRG, makes sense. And between them, it's very comparable. You lose one digit somewhere, you win another digit somewhere. It's pretty much the same. There's an interesting point here, which is that for us, we require much higher bond dimension to get to these quality results. But because the algorithm is way faster, we can also run these results. So we need bond dimension 120 to get results for which TNR needs 24, maybe. But we can also run this in roughly the same time as that. So if you have an hour of computational time to spare, it's pretty much a tie of which of these methods you want to go with. With our argument being that ours, the advantage of our algorithm being that it's more simple, rather than that it's more performant.
But sorry, didn't you just say it was slower than the other algorithms, like in the last slide?
It's slower than TRG.
Oh.
It's slower than the simple split things and contract them together, because TRG is just the last part of our algorithm. But it's significantly faster than these fancier algorithms that have the disentanglers and all this complicated stuff. An interesting point here as well is that this is the bond dimension before we do the guilt truncation. The guilt truncation then pushes it down to very similar numbers as here. And then again, you do this last part and bounces up to 120. So it keeps oscillating the bond dimension. So in some sense, we can compress the same information down to the similar bond dimension. But these algorithms just never let the bond dimension grow larger, whereas ours just jumps up and down between the end of that step and the end of this step. OK. So what have we achieved? We have what I would call a proper tensor network RG method. Does really physically correct RG. That is based on this guilt thing that performs comparably to the best that exists. That is simple to implement. By that I mean that I wrote a minimal version of this and it took me 100 lines. There's no iterative optimization. There's no getting stuck in local minima. There's no, oh, it's converging slowly today. There's none of that. It's much more simple in this sense than.
So if you transform one edge with, say, the lower neighborhood and then transform it with the upper neighborhood, does it remain transformed with respect to the lower neighborhood? If you want edge in two loops, then?
Yeah. You couldn't reintroduce the same kind of correlations that you removed in the earlier stage by fiddling around with the upper bracket. Is that what you mean?
Yes.
Yeah, no, that doesn't. You essentially cut things away, and they are not coming back. then the thing that pleases me most about this is that this really, designing this algorithm for any graph or lattice, any tensor network, is absolutely trivial. It works exactly the same way. The computational cost keeps changing, of course, depending on if you're looking at a plaquette, or if you're looking at a hexagon, or if you're looking at a cube. But typically, the computational cost is decently low. Like, for instance, it's roughly the same as the computational cost of contracting that neighborhood in the first place. So, well, first of all, this is a fine algorithm in 2D to add to the list of things you can do if you want to attack your favorite 2D lattice model, 2D classical lattice model, or 1D quantum spin chain. We are also thinking of other ways of using this guild procedure. And then this is the thing that really motivated us in the beginning. Hopefully, this could lead us to be able to do the same thing in 3D. And that would be a big step, because typically tensor network algorithms they get way more complicated and way more computationally expensive when you go to higher spatial dimensions, because they're so geometric. You just get more legs and it all gets more involved. So that's something we are working on still, but let me give you a few words about that. So first of all, this issue of local correlations is much worse in higher dimensions. What I mean by that is that essentially, like I said, you can think of a toy model. So this would be the 3D equivalent of the toy model I was showing you earlier, extremely local correlations. You can think of this as local entanglement. And just by the area law, you know that if in 3D you start looking at larger and larger coarse graining blocks, you're putting more and more of the physics into a single tensor. If you're not dealing with the local entanglement correctly, by the area law, the amount of entanglement between your coarse graining block and the rest of the lattice is going to be growing. And that means your bond dimension would have to grow exponentially fast to be able to keep the truncation errors from getting out of hand. So the need for something like guild TNR or TNR or one of these fancier methods is much more dire in higher dimensions. As TRG can pretty easily be generalized to 3D, but because it doesn't fix this problem, it's in a bit of trouble. Doing this guild thing for a cube is just a matter of taking a cube, cutting that one leg open, doing the SVD between these two legs and all the external legs, and you can recycle some of the same code. There's no issues in designing that step of the algorithm. And the computational cost is one dimension to the 12th power, which for these 3D methods is not all that bad. I'm also hoping that we can push it lower. So for instance, the TRG equivalent in 3D, which is called HOTRG, higher order TRG, is one dimension the 11th. So just to give you an idea of where these computational costs float. Also, that's way worse than the one dimension the 6th that we were dealing with in 2D. But still, this is work in progress. We have a version of the code that is running, but it needs significant improvement still. There's all kinds of details about improving performance and all that stuff. So if you want to go check out our 2D code, use it for your favorite lattice model, that can be found there. And also our work in progress 3D code can be found there. So if you want to submit pull requests, then feel free. And that's all. Thanks. Can I ask myself a question?
You can ask me a question, I'll ask you.
Sorry?
You ask me a question, I'll ask you the same.
Okay. Yeah. The question would be, some people here may have heard that this TNR algorithm gives, this algorithm with this disentanglement gives rise to a mirror when you apply it to a network like that represents a quantum state. What happens if we apply our algorithm to a network like that?
What happens?
This happens. So we can produce, this would be a network that represents the ground state of some Hamiltonian that you can get by doing coarse graining on a network that represents the ground state the way I showed in the beginning. So this is kind of like a mirror, but not a mirror. There's no unitarity constraints on these tensors, and that's the main difference. I don't know how many people are familiar here with mirror, but I know some are, so that's why I'm telling you this.
Well, the mirror also is broken, right? I mean, there's a connected, disconnected, connected, disconnected, if you look at one level.
Yes, like there would be an isometry and then this
in
one. Sorry?
This one is more symmetric in that
sense. Yes, well, yeah. Anyway, this does treat these two sides quite differently from these two sides, though. And that's kind of like the equivalent. But yeah, I would definitely want to agree with you. And this has the same feature as mirror, that if you run this for a scale invariant state, for instance, then this will become symmetric in the layers. The next layer is going to look the same as the previous layer. But the main difference to a mirror, I would say, from the point of view of using it, is that mirror has these strict causal cones because of the isometricity and unitarity constraints. Those don't happen here. We probably have some kind of approximate causal cones. Like, I don't expect correlations to like spread out wildly, but there's no strict notion of causal cones in the same way as there is in the mirror. Any other questions? Jake?
So you're saying that the computational cost of guilt is the same, like k to the sixth, the same as TNR? But then you show that the time for how do you match?
Because the computational cost I'm giving here is just the highest, the leading order. What is the exponent of the leading order? And the constant factors are way smaller in our case. And the easy way to understand that is that when you do TNR, you have this iterative optimization that updates one tensor and then the next tensor and then goes back to the same tensor and updates and keeps bouncing back and forth between these different tensors. And that may take 1,000 iterations to converge. So then you have 1,000 times Bond dimension of the six, whereas we have maybe 10 times Bond dimension of the six because there's no need to, you just do these four legs and then there's a few other Bond dimension of the six operations and you're done.
Yeah, but in 3D, I guess the Bond dimension should be much larger.
Possibly, yeah. That's the scary thought that may be necessary.
Yes.
But in 3D, so HOTRG, so just like put things together and split them apart, do coarse graining, is already Bond dimension 11. I don't know of any way of doing anything fancier that removes all the local correlations that would be anywhere near as cheap. Designing something like TNR in 3D is highly analogous to designing a 2D mirror algorithm. And what's the lowest so far for 2D mirror? Bond dimension of the 16th, something like that?
Possibly.
Yeah, I remember the first one was like Bond dimension 28th, and then it went down a little bit. So I'm already very happy if we stay around this mark.
This raises the question of to what extent the asymptotic complexity tells you how your algorithm really performs.
That's a good point, yeah. Yeah. I could be happy with an algorithm that has a higher exponent over there if the constant factor is much more.
So Mira's causal cones are an important part of the reason that calculating some sort of correlation function is easy in Mira, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But so if you try to use this for correlation functions with your algorithm, seeing as they don't have causal cones, would it be much worse? Like, would it take a lot more time to calculate correlation functions?
I don't think so, because you can use if you write the network down for a correlation function here, mm-hmm. it's essentially it can be contracted using the exact same algorithm that you use for the partition function. So I could write down,
but
it doesn't have the same kind of nice properties where, for instance, you can just look at the network and a bunch of the unitaries cancel.
Mm-hmm.
But you can still reduce it down to doing local contractions of local things scale by scale. So what I'm essentially saying is that if you want to calculate the two-point correlator, for instance,
mm-hmm.
then you could have an O over here, and then this network would continue, and you'd have another operator somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be the same thing as constructing this network that I showed you with the purple things in the scale structure on top and below, and then the O's in the middle. And you can just contract that exactly the same way as you're contracting that. You just have to run one case for the homogeneous lattice, one case for each of the impurities, coarse-graining the impurity step by step, and then at the end join them together.
Yeah, but the point with Mira was that the number of actual contractions you had to do was much, much less when you were calculating collision moments, right?
Yes. Like, for instance, the scaling in terms of the system size or the distance between the two of them would be logarithmic.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and the same would hold here. Because you can do a coarse graining of your local operator, the next length scale, until the two end up being nearest neighbors.
I see. What about like the rest of the system? If you have an infinite system, okay.
Yeah.
Coarse grain till the nearest neighbors, but you still have to contract all the rest of the guys.
Yes, that would be, yeah, that's the thing where a difference with Mera does appear. So with a Mera, you could imagine really having an infinite system and you would just, everything on one side and on the other side would just perfectly cancel.
Yes.
Here you can do it for a really large system, but it's not going to be strictly infinite. You can do it for a strictly large system by just doing the coarse graining of the homogeneous network and contracting it. Your impurity tensors with those. Yes.
You say something on the effect of choosing different neighborhoods? Like
so. Where was it? Yeah. So here, what we do is, for instance, these four tensors are created by looking at that plaquette as the neighborhood, and that means only these correlations get removed. You could also create, for instance, this R prime 2 by looking at both of these together as the neighborhood. Presumably, that would give you a slightly more accurate. I tried it and actually didn't make that much of a difference. Helped a little, but not much. But then the computational cost is a little larger. And always, whenever you choose the neighborhood, you're essentially saying, truncate this leg, removing everything that is internal to this neighborhood. So the larger the neighborhood, the more stuff is internal to it. And then you can truncate a little more, but probably doing the SVD that you need for doing the truncation, contracting the neighborhood and doing the SVD is more expensive. Does that answer what you are thinking?
Yeah, so like in principle, is it always that you'd rather keep computational cost small and choose like smaller neighborhoods? So is there some room for optimizing there?
There could be. So far I've only done numerics on this in on the square and a bit on the cube. There it seems that it's the optimal choice is just do the minimal thing because it does well enough and it's the cheapest. But I don't have a strict reason for saying why that wouldn't always be the case. For instance, I didn't know that using two neighboring plaquettes as the environment wasn't worth the cost before I tried it. Did something remain? Yes, no, you answered your own question.
Yeah.
The answer is that they are unitary, so that's why it works out the way it does.
Have you submitted your research proposal?
To any
yeah.
No.
Yeah.
Last
week we have looked.
Yes. Questions?
Yeah, I had a question.
Sure.
Could you go back a few slides? I just want to
Yes.
Yeah.
Sorry. Which slide?
The one where you have like pictures of you going through going through your algorithm for the most general case,
okay.
For most explicit.
This.
Which is a bit more. I think on slide 8 or 9. Sorry.
The whole.
Yeah.
Okay.
Sorry.
This thing.
Okay. So here, if I'm interpreting this correctly, you guys are splitting up each like you guys are making a lattice of plaques that you guys are contracting individually, like
sorry,
all at once. So like you guys contract these.
Mm. Yeah.
And then do it in square plaques. Now, is there any more advantage to splitting it up into halves and then halves and then halves and then doing the halves individually? Because, when I saw this, it reminded me of like different algorithms using computer science where they just implement like merge sort. Is they just cut up the problem into tinier pieces, and then each one individually, they become easier to manage, and then you can slowly merge them together. So what I'm proposing is that you slowly start breaking up correlations locally over larger and larger blocks, but you're still cutting it up. And that usually provides a large speed up. And
so would you propose essentially doing something like this, like introducing the matrices that do the truncation, but looking at only half of this neighborhood?
No, so like you have the giant lattice.
Uh-huh.
You break all correlations straight down the middle,
mm-hmm.
straight across the side.
Oh.
And then deal with each one of the blocks individually.
Yes, okay.
So you can have...
I see. Okay, let's see. So what happens here is that we assume translation invariance,
mm-hmm.
which means that we only have to look at the single plaquette.
Mm-hmm.
We figure out what these four are,
mm-hmm.
and then we put all the same four tendrils everywhere. So numerically, we actually only deal with the single plaquette.
Okay,
but you could imagine a case where this would be non-homogeneous. And in that case, I wonder if it would be helpful if you do, say, proposing... Let's imagine that this is all an inhomogeneous system.
Yeah.
You would propose inserting these over here and then those over there.
Yeah.
And that would somehow possibly make easier to...
Yes.
to yeah, that could be the case because then your bond dimensions over there are lower.
Exactly.
Yeah. Like,
so basically, if you cut this down here, put that down there, and you can contract these, and you would get rid of the local correlations, they wouldn't affect you globally, and you did it in less turns.
Yes, if you can afford contracting
this. Yeah.
But in general, like you should probably design your algorithm in such a way that you have to start by doing truncation on some plaquette, and then do whatever is the next plaquette that is the cheapest to do, as long
after
as
that one.
Yeah, right. Yeah, mm-hmm. exactly. Taking into account that you've already reduced some of the bond dimensions, and then do as like the minimal amount of things that you need
mm-hmm.
to be able to contract the. Like,
mm-hmm.
like for instance, here we just don't deal with these plaquettes because
yeah.
they end up being here
away.
And they just go away
yeah.
by themselves. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But this is just for 2D, but I think in more applications with 3 dimensions is the problem you mentioned before to Eric, I think.